by U.S. Marshals, setting off a deadly riot over the desegregation of that university. Our quote of the day is from Ethel Rosenberg, who said, "It is difficult for me to make any comment beyond the expression of horror at the shameless haste with which the government appears to be pressing for our liquidation."
It's 5:21, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Donald Trump is for it. Barack Obama is too, as are Jeb Bush and Hillary Clinton. It is the idea of finally ending a ridiculous tax loophole that was written by and for the richest, most pampered elites on Wall Street. An obscurely titled carried interest tax break allows billionaire hedge fund hucksters to have their massive incomes taxed at a much lower rate than the one teachers, Main Street businesses, carpenters, and other modest income people must pay. This privileged treatment of money shufflers over people who do constructive work in our society adds to America's widening chasm of inequality. It's so unfair and unpopular that even Trump and Bush see that it has to go. So it's bye-bye loophole, right? Ha, just kidding. Trump can mouth all he wants, but no animal hath such fury as a hedge funder whose special tax boondoggle is threatened. Trump had barely gotten the word unfair out of his puffy lips before the tax loophole profiteers deployed battalions of lobbyists, PR flacks, and front group operatives to defend their precious carried interest provision. Just one group, with the arcane name of Private Equity Growth Capital Council, rushed a dozen Gucci-clad lobbyists to Capitol Hill to, quote, inform lawmakers about the virtues of coddling Wall Street elites with tax favors. Of course, informing meant flashing their checkbooks at key members of Congress. After all, even the loudest blast of political talk is cheap, and it's the silent sound of a pen writing out a campaign check that makes Washington whirl keep spinning in favor of the rich. This is Jim Hightower saying, sure enough, Representative Paul Ryan and Senator Orrin Hatch, the two lawmakers who head Congress's tax writing committees, quickly announced that, the will of the people aside, there would be no repeal of the hedge fund loophole anytime soon.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Negotiations for the Trans-Pacific Partnership began on a shaky note in Atlanta this morning after talks collapsed during a meeting held in Hawaii over the summer. Among the terms and conditions at issue are the rules for regulating how much pharmaceutical products can remain a monopolized property. A team from watchdog group Public Citizen was sent to monitor the proceedings, and KBOO reporter Robin Ryan spoke with one of their directors about the role this process has had in stalling negotiations.
I'm talking with Peter Maybarduke, the Director of Global Access to Medicines for Public Citizen. We're going to talk about the negotiations going on for the Trans-Pacific Partnership in Atlanta. Why has your organization staged an entire team of fair trade advocates at this meeting?
I've been tracking this negotiation for 5 years. What are called trade agreements are unfortunately large economic rulemakings pushed largely by corporate interests and big business interests, economic deregulation, corporate subsidies, financial services, intellectual property, investment rules, things that in the end wind up affecting our environmental standards, our labor standards, and in the case of my work in particular, health, our ability to access affordable medicines in the United States and every other country. And this negotiation is under attack through a series of pharmaceutical industry-sponsored rules. Dozens and dozens of pages of very complex rules that are being negotiated in secret. And we can only find out what's going on by tracking these negotiations and finding ways to build relationships with the negotiators in the corridors over time, figuring out which folks from which countries might be on our side and joining forces to fight back against pharma. But it is one of the biggest forums for economic decision making that affects all of our lives that you don't have a voice in directly, because these are all rules that would otherwise be debated in our parliaments and congresses. And instead, they're being worked out by trade ministers behind closed doors at resort hotels all over the world.
If I'm counting correctly, the number of negotiations for the Trans-Pacific Partnership is now somewhere in the 20s. It sounds like they've had almost monthly meetings described as informal throughout this year.
Yeah, we're somewhere past 20 rounds. I've lost count. For several years, they've been telling us that they're in the final round or the final stages. But fortunately for us, there are enough good-hearted people doing their best to represent their people's interests, whatever country they might be from, who aren't inclined to agree to a lot of terrible corporate-sponsored rules.
What would you say prompted the impasse at the recent negotiations in Hawaii, where the talks are reported to have collapsed?
The talks collapsed around just three issues, and one of them was medicine affordability. So our government, unfortunately, has advanced this proposal on behalf of the biopharmaceutical industry that would ensure that cancer medicines and a number of other new treatments that are what are called biotech drugs or biologics are automatically monopolized for a minimum period of 8 years in every TPP country. So that means like a poor country like Vietnam, they're going to have these cancer drugs coming online that cost more than $100,000, and there's just no way the people or their government will be able to pay, so people will just die because there won't be affordable biosimilar competition on the market. We're going to have to wait more years till we can get those sort of alternatives online. Fortunately, a number of negotiators from smaller and developing countries are having none of it. They think this is terrible for their people, and so they're fighting back and united around that. And they said no to the U.S. government in Maui. That was the first of three issues to gum up the talks. The second was about a dairy market access, and the third about automobiles, and it was a NAFTA issue. And at that point, they just called it quits. So usually these negotiations don't collapse around any one issue. It's sort of, you have to have a constellation of problems that you can't really solve until the momentum is drained from the talks. We're hoping that here in Atlanta that dynamic continues and that these countries continue to stand strong against one of the world's most powerful industries and saying no to long cancer drug monopolies and denying people of access to affordable treatment. That's why we're here, and that's the dynamic we're hoping we'll keep up.
Are you going to be back in D.C. next week?
I will be back in D.C. this week keeping up a fight in the nation's capital. We got a lot of work to do in Congress.
There's going to be a hearing next week with Jason Chaffetz's government oversight and reform committee. Apparently the discussion is going to be about the increase in pharmaceutical prices.
It's a national scandal, and the fact that we don't give ourselves even negotiating power, let alone the quite reasonable ability to strip companies of their monopoly power when appropriate. We actually have that in the law, but we don't exercise it. That's a public policy outrage. We should not be allowing this kind of monopoly control over products that are so important to people's lives, especially when we subsidize the industry the way we do. We put in $30 billion a year in public funding of biomedical research, and then we let the companies screw us on the back end. It's just not okay.
I've been talking with Peter Mabarduk. He is Director of Global Access to Medicines with Public Citizen. For more information, you can visit their website at citizen.org. I'm Robin Ryan, and you're listening to KBOO News.
A diverse coalition of conservation, press, academic, and animal protection groups filed suit today in federal court in Wyoming. The groups are seeking to strike down a pair of Wyoming state laws that stifle freedom of speech and make citizen science illegal in the state. The suit claims that the laws violate the U.S. Constitution by punishing communication to government agencies of photos and data taken on open land. These photos are considered to be data trespass, according to the Wyoming law. But the coalition of groups that filed today's lawsuit say that the law is an attempt to undercut protection of public lands and the environment. The legislative sponsors of the law, which went into effect this May, were open about the fact that the bills were crafted to deter members of the public from gathering information about environmental degradation. The laws punish persons who gather information about land or resources and then communicate or plan to communicate that information to government agencies. The laws are written so expansively that they could even be interpreted to criminalize submission of photographs to the National Park Service from some popular tourist sites in the state, such as the Grand Tetons, Devil's Tower, and Yellowstone National Park. The law came in direct response to Western Watershed Project's collection of water quality data to highlight agricultural impacts to publicly owned land and streams in the state.
The State Department released more emails today from the private Clinton email server. Hillary Clinton has been under fire since it was revealed that she's been using a private email address and server to conduct government business. Hillary Clinton has maintained that none of the messages sent or received to that email server contained any classified information. However, government intelligence says that it has identified classified information as well as emails that were not originally reported by the Clinton office. The emails released today contain communications dating from late 2010 to early 2011. The emails being released are from around the time of a large government leak of classified information to the site WikiLeaks. The emails also contain communications about the Arab Spring uprisings that were going on at that time, as well as the ousting of Muammar Gaddafi and the Syrian and Libyan civil wars. A total of about 6,000 pages of emails have been released, and the remainder of Clinton's emails should be available by January. The State Department plans to release about 37% of Clinton's emails to the public, and so far, no surprising information has been found in those emails.
Russian sources have stated today that they have carried out at least 20 airstrikes in Syria with the consent of Damascus against Islamic State or ISIS and other anti-government rebel targets. Syria is in the fifth of a year of a bloody civil war fought by multiple sides, including ISIS. While the world community overwhelmingly supports fighting ISIS, U.S. and Russian officials are publicly divided on the best strategy to defeat them. The U.S. government has provided support to rebels trying to oust Syrian President Bashar al-Assad and has pursued a regime change strategy for Syria. Russia, on the other hand, is an ally of the Assad government and has offered military support to them to defeat the rebels in Syria on multiple fronts. Both superpowers accuse the other of acting with ulterior motives, serving their own imperial agendas. The airstrikes reportedly came as a surprise to U.S. officials after Russia's President Putin met with Obama the day before, and the two discussed the possibility of coordinating actions in Syria. Earlier in the day, both had addressed the U.N. General Assembly. Russian airstrikes commenced in Syria within hours after the two leaders' meeting ended.
In the latest news from U.S.-occupied Afghanistan, 2 days after Taliban fighters launched a surprise attack and took control of the northern city of Kunduz, U.S. Special Forces have joined the Afghan military in a counterattack to take back control of that city. Afghan President Ashraf Ghani has promised that his forces could quickly retake the city, but after 2 days of heavy fighting, the city remains under Taliban control. Kunduz is the first provincial capital to fall to the Taliban since the hardline Islamist movement was toppled from power in 2001. Historian Juan Cole argues the fall of Kunduz offers key lessons for today, while also speaking directly to the inherent flaws of U.S. foreign policy over the last 15 years. Cole says the fall of Kunduz symbolizes the final collapse of the so-called nation-building program launched by former President George W. Bush in Afghanistan. In addition to the U.S. Special Forces, soldiers who are now on the ground engaging in combat in Kunduz, the U.S. military has also launched a round of airstrikes.
Seven people are dead and many others are injured after blasts rocked the Chinese city of Luzhou. Authorities say that as many as 17 bombs were placed in the mail and exploded over the course of a couple hours. Photos on social media include a nearly demolished five-story building. Chinese officials have arrested a suspect and say that the case is a criminal one and not terrorism. China has seen crimes like this before, and most are related to mental health problems or revenge. Chinese authorities instructed citizens not to open any packages. The latest estimate says that as many as 50 are wounded and 7 are dead.
And now the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.imemc.org for Wednesday, September 30th, 2015. During his UN speech, Palestinian President demanded international protection for the Palestinian people. Meanwhile, Israeli troops bombard Gaza. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. The Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas demanded on Wednesday an international protection to the Palestinian people to stop the Israeli army attacks targeting communities in East Jerusalem, the West Bank, and the Gaza Strip. During his speech at the UN 70th General Assembly, Abbas said that if Israel continue to violate the Oslo Agreement, then the Palestinians will stop honoring it using peaceful and legal means. President Abbas warned from the continued violations and attacks committed by the Israeli army and extremists against Al-Aqsa Mosque in Jerusalem and other holy sites. The Palestinian president demanded international protection and asked countries to recognize the Palestinian state and help in the Israeli occupation. Also on Wednesday, the Palestinian flag was officially risen outside the UN building next to the world flags.
On the ground, Israeli army tanks stationed along the borders with Gaza bombarded four sites that are used by Al-Qassam Brigade, the army of Hamas. According to media sources, the sites were empty and that the bombing caused damage but no injuries. The army claimed that the attack was in response to two homemade shells fired from Gaza on Tuesday late at night and were destroyed by the Iron Dome defense system. No Palestinian group claimed responsibility for the two rockets. Moreover, Israeli army tanks invaded areas in the eastern part of the Gaza Strip on Wednesday morning and bulldozed farmlands before leaving. In the West Bank, clashes continued for the fourth day in Jerusalem Old City after radical Israeli settlers entered Al-Aqsa Mosque. Palestinian sources also reported clashes in Bethlehem, Hebron and Ramallah cities as people protested the Israeli violations in Al-Aqsa. Israeli forces detained at least 36 Palestinians across occupied East Jerusalem and the West Bank overnight on Tuesday, a day after violent clashes took place across the occupied Palestinian territories. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Wednesday, September 30th, 2015 news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Shmawi and me, Ghassan Badnoura.
Two new reports were released today documenting a widespread campaign on college campuses across the U.S. to stifle free speech on the issue of Israel and Palestine. The first report, co-authored by the Center for Constitutional Rights and the group Palestine Legal, examined nearly 300 incidents of attempted suppression of pro-Palestine activism and rhetoric in the past 18 months. The group Jewish Voice for Peace also released a report entitled Stifling Dissent, How Israel's Defenders Use False Charges of Antisemitism to Limit the Debate Over Israel on Campus. The report documents efforts by Israel advocacy organizations to intervene in the debate over Israeli policies on college campuses. Drawing on case studies over the last several years, the report documents how Israel advocacy organizations bully and intimidate Jewish students who don't toe the line on the issue of Israel. For more, KBOO's Jenka Soderberg spoke with Naomi Dan with Jewish Voice for Peace.
If you could just lay out the main findings of this report.
Our report is called Stifling Dissent, and it's about different tactics that are being used by advocacy organizations to silence activism for Palestinian rights on campuses. And we found that there are a number of different types of ways that people are intimidated to stop this kind of activism. There are false charges of anti-Semitism that are lobbied both at non-Jews and at Jewish students. There's intimidation of faculty and students through blacklists, letters to administrators, demanding that events are canceled or classes canceled, enforcing boundaries of the political debate within spaces like Hillel on campuses, intervening in campus politics, such as funneling money to specific pro-Israel candidates for student government, and other forms of legal action against student activists.
And how widespread is this problem on campuses in the U.S. as far as students who support Palestinian rights getting targeted or accused falsely of anti-Semitism?
It's actually incredibly widespread. One of our partner organizations, Palestine Legal, who also released a report today called The Palestine Exception to the Free Speech, has been documenting incidences where students or faculty request their legal assistance in protecting themselves from these attacks, and they've documented over 300 separate incidents in the last 18 months alone.
Now, the response to that report by a number of groups supportive of Israeli policies, including Stand With Us, said that these are groups crying victim when, in fact, they are engaging in anti-Semitism. And she mentions the three D's of anti-Semitism: demonization, double standards, and delegitimization. What do you think that that standard means, and why does it not apply in these cases?
So there's actually a large section of the report deals with that definition, this demonization, delegitimization, and double standard to Israel. That's a really problematic definition of anti-Semitism because it equates criticizing the policies of a country, Israel, with the kinds of bigotry discrimination targeted at Jewish people purely because of their Jewishness. So we are a Jewish organization who are doing this work because of our commitment to human rights and our commitment to international law and in solidarity with Palestinians who are living under occupation or displaced from their homes. And so when we see groups like Stand With Us or the Israeli government saying that it's anti-Semitic to criticize their country for policies that are hurting people, we see that as a misuse of that term, anti-Semitism, and it really actually makes it more difficult to distinguish what is really bigotry against Jewish people and criticism of a country.
Wow. Well, I want to thank you for joining us. I've been speaking with Naomi Dan. She's with Jewish Voice for Peace, who has published a report about the stifling of free speech on campus in the name of anti-Semitism, and particularly students that are advocating for Palestinian rights and for boycott, divestment, and sanctions of the Israeli government are targeted on campus. This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Robin Ryan and Joe Aaron. Our producer is Jimmy Tardy. Our engineer is Ian Westmoreland. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews, or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. If you'd like to call your elected representatives about any issue you've heard about on the news tonight, here are their numbers, so grab something to write with. The local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. Oregon Governor Kate Brown's number is 503-378-3111. And Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120. You are listening to KBOO Portland at 90.7 FM, on K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR in Hood River at 91.9 FM. I'm Brian Pritchett.
And I'm Aaron J. Bernard. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO. At 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, on Voices from the Edge, talk radio host Joanne Hardesty speaks with Stanley Nelson, director of the Black Panthers, Vanguard of the Revolution. At 9, it's Press Watch, news you're not supposed to know. At 9:30 on Fight the Empire, host Per Fagerang speaks with investigative journalist Robert Perry of Consortium News about Vladimir Putin, Syria, and the groupthink in Washington. At 10, hear Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. At 11, on Between the Covers, host David Nyman speaks with legendary local writer Ursula K. Le Guin about the new edition of her book, Steering the Craft, a 21st century guide to sailing the sea of story. And at 11:30, it's Black Book Talk, a monthly program featuring interviews and discussions of works by Black authors. Thanks for listening to KBOO, and thanks KBOO members for your generous support in our recent membership drive. You can still contribute by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. Stay tuned now for News from the Boo, where we'll feature Scott Blue Flames Kalama, a hip-hop artist and MC from the Warm Springs Reservation.
And now it's time for KBOO News from the Boo with
Mike
and
Monica Beamer.
Like I was saying, it is Wednesday, 5:45, which means it is once again time for News from the Boo, our weekly program where we discuss issues of interest here at the station and in the greater listening community. Mike and Monica are both away tonight, but instead we've got a very special presentation that we want to share with you. Aaron stole my thunder a little bit there at the end of the newscast. We're going to be hearing a feature about Scott Blue Flames Kalama. He's a hip-hop artist and an MZ from the Warm Springs Reservation. And away we go.
So this is Mike Crenshaw on News from the Boo, our Wednesday news segment that we broadcast from KBOO here. And I'm on the phone with Scott Kalama, a.k.a. Blue Flames.